I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining us in an ongoing quest for the awe and the wonder that await each of us every day and all around. Awe can be found in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, in spiritual encounters that move us beyond words. Your host for this episode is Constant Wonder producer Eric Schultzke.
A falcon is built to fly. A snake is built to slither. A worm is built to squirm. So what is a seahorse built for? At first glance, a seahorse looks absurd. It looks more silly than a giraffe, more mythical than a unicorn. It has a curled bony tail with a horsey head, an absurdly underpowered propulsion system that consists of a single fluttering fairy wing that moves it through the water at 5 feet per hour. And yet there it is, serenely swaying, upright but awkward, and then it turns an angle and it's gone.
We had a group of divers in a semicircle watching a seahorse. In front of all of us, we talked about it afterwards, the seahorse just vanished. Next minute, we saw it coming out about 4 or 5 feet away through the seagrass. It literally turned, vanished into the seagrass and came out beyond us. So, yeah.
So what are seahorses built for? Maybe they're built for just being very hard to see.
From the side on, a seahorse is actually quite wide. From the front of its belly to its back to its dorsal fin, it's quite wide. But turn edge on, they're about the thickness of a piece of seagrass. So you imagine when a seahorse is in amongst the seagrass and it turns its back to you, because the colour is very similar, it looks like a bit of seagrass and it just vanishes. So yeah, amazing.
Neil Garrick Maidment is England's seahorse guru, a man who's worked tirelessly for years to protect England's seahorses. In fact, to prove they even exist. He's found them and then watched them disappear in some very unlikely places.
Our new study site in Torbay, which is in the south of England, in Devon, we went down there with the idea that there probably wouldn't be seahorses there because it didn't seem right. It didn't seem as though it was the right sort of place. And on the second dive down, suddenly it was there, that classic horse head shape, just sticking out just behind a seagrass leaf. And it looked so obvious when I saw it. But I can imagine lots of people would have just swam past and not even known it was there. In fact, the two dive buddies I had with me, who are very good at spotting seahorses, I had to put their fingers right next to the seahorse to get them to realise it was there in front of them, which is quite surprising because they weren't small. I mean, the first one we saw was probably about 4.5-5 inches from the top of the head to the end of the tail. So not a little animal.
Here at Constant Wonder, we often marvel at the improbable natural phenomena like the seahorse. We also marvel at the human spirit, and especially at the spirit of people who devote incredible energy and love to understanding the world and helping other people do the same. So in this episode of Constant Wonder, we're going to learn more about that wondrous fish, the seahorse, and we'll also be getting to know a pair of genuinely wondrous human beings.
Seahorses, the males are quite amazing. They are literally the only animal in the animal kingdom where a male will get truly pregnant. And by getting truly pregnant, what I mean is he has a brood pouch hanging underneath his belly. The female will actually put the eggs inside him. And very much like a mammal, he has a placenta, so a lining inside the pouch. The eggs embed into the lining of the pouch. And through that placenta, he receives food, oxygen, blood, everything it needs for the babies to actually survive. Now, depending on the species, the smallest species, it could be 15 days, but the bigger seahorses, roughly 28 days, they start to have contractions, and the contractions can go on for 12 hours or so. And then at the final moment, the male gives birth to these perfectly formed miniature seahorses that actually just swim off. And that's it. That's the end of his parental care. But I always think that the seahorse male is not very bright because within 24 hours, he's normally pregnant again. So he just keeps doing it time and time again.
Neil Garrick Maidment's Seahorse Saga is a study in how persistence can overcome ignorance. Neil's English seahorses weren't supposed to be there. For years, his claims that seahorses were thriving in temperate or even cold waters off the English coast were met with incredulity and even hostility.
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of pushback. People were convinced that seahorses were just a tropical animal. They weren't indigenous to the British Isles or in cold water and stuff like that. And even now, people don't believe we have seahorses in the British Isles, even though we've got thousands of records now. Even the authorities, whose job it is to protect the seahorses and protect wildlife in our country, didn't believe us we had seahorses here. And then eventually they were accepted. I got both species protected in 2008, so they're fully legally protected here in the UK, and they're now fully recognised, which is great.
Neil's pathway to seahorse stardom began when he was a small boy soaking in the warm waters off the Mediterranean island of Malta.
I was born and brought up in Devon in England, but I also spent 10 years of my young days in Malta in the Mediterranean, constantly in the water, constantly observing things. So nature has always been a part and parcel of my life. Malta was gorgeous. My father was in the military and we were based over there for 10 years. And I used to go to school quite early in the morning, finished about 2 o'clock. And the rest of the day was spent either roaming or in the sea, snorkeling. I'd taught myself to dive over there. Weekends were just spent roaming around the island. I was always out roaming around, collecting animals, snakes, lizards, all sorts of creatures, fish. We had tanks in my house. Poor old mum and dad had to put up with me sort of bringing them all home, but I only ever kept them for a few days just so I could understand them, study them, and then I put them back in the wild. I was 14 when I started diving. I used to free dive a lot. I was quite good at free diving. I could be underwater for quite a few minutes free diving, and but I wanted to stay down there. I was desperate to be under the ocean, and being inspired by the likes of Jacques Cousteau, I just wanted to learn scuba. So I borrowed a friend's scuba gear, a couple of quick pointers, and then I was in the water and off I went, and I've been diving ever since. I wouldn't recommend doing it that way, to be honest. I'd take proper lessons and learn how to do it properly, and they wouldn't be allowed to lend you equipment like that anymore. It was a freer, simpler world back then. And I survived it. That's the great thing. I've done probably about 4,000 dives now in my life.
When Neil did return to England, he began volunteering at a local aquarium, and he started working with seahorses when the aquarium owner, who was struggling to keep his seahorses alive, turned the project over to Neil.
And so I kept it very simple. I kept the seahorses in a very simple type of aquarium. The one thing I did do that a lot of people don't and are still not doing is I had a lot of current moving in the water, so the seahorses were constantly moving around. I got food from the local sea, so I sieved out plankton. I got the bigger food for the adult seahorses when they eventually grew. Living by the river, there's a certain way of catching small shrimp that come alongside hard areas like quaysides and bridges and stuff like that. And you reach down with a very large shrimp net and just literally scoop them out of the water into a bucket of water that you've collected from the estuary. And it seemed to work. Here we are, 50 sort of odd years later, and I've closed the life cycle of 22 species of seahorse now, more than anybody else in the world, and literally bred to maturity hundreds of thousands of seahorses by keeping it simple.
You keep using that word simple, but it doesn't sound simple at all.
Oh, every day is quite a mammoth job, to be honest, because what we'd have to do is think for the future. So if you imagine a 5-gallon bucket, I probably collected 4 or 5 of those a day, absolutely rammed full of shrimp. Now, the ones we didn't use within 24 hours, we actually froze down into little cubicles. Imagine ice cube containers, so little tiny ice cubes of shrimp. So that in the winter, we trained all our seahorses to feed on dead food as well as live food. Live food obviously is better because that's what they do in the wild. So in the winter, when we couldn't get any live shrimp, we would just drop the ice cubes of shrimp into the tanks and they would feed them as they dropped down in the water. So yeah, huge amounts every single day when we could get it. But it all depended on the weather, to be honest.
Neil is the first to admit that the seahorses as a hobby very soon overflowed their banks. And in the early years, that meant that Neil's own house and his own family were awash in seahorse tanks.
The hobby outgrew everything, to be honest. When I started working with the seahorses, things built up and I started to have one tank, then two tanks. And as you bred more seahorses, three tanks, four tanks, to eventually it did overwhelm the house. Luckily, we lived in quite a large house then and we had four floors to the house. So we had a basement and three other floors. And so you'd come into the hallway, tanks in there, then you would go down to the basement and the tanks all over the place down there. And that's where the main area was. And that's where I kept the live food for the seahorses. That's where I bred the baby seahorses, the fryers we call them. And most of it was in the hallway going into the house and down into the basement. So yeah, quite crazy it was. We ended up with 26 seahorse tanks, plus all the tanks for preparing the food for the seahorses. But that led on to us starting our very first public aquarium, which was the world's first seahorse aquarium of its kind, specialist centre here in Exeter, where I actually live now. And we transferred all those tanks that we had at home, much to the relief of everybody because it was taking up so much room. And we moved into our own public aquarium, which is a tiny place. It was very small, but we had people literally coming from all over the world, from America, Australia, Belgium, Germany, everywhere they were coming to see our collection. We had about 46,000 visitors a year, which was not bad for a very small aquarium.
And before you moved the tanks, your family was putting up with this?
It's funny. Obviously, they were very proud of it and their friends used to come and see it and all the rest of it. But like all things, when it's a normal part of your life, you just get used to it. And so after a while, it's just dad playing with the seahorses again and that sort of thing. But it did lead on, like I say, to my wife and I setting up the aquarium.
Getting seahorses recognized, getting them literally seen in the water, and then legally protected on shore has been a huge accomplishment. But Neil isn't resting on his corals.
Every dive I go on, I learn something new. I mean, even after all this long period of time, we know the basics about seahorses, but we don't know the real intricacies. There's a lot more things to learn about them. And one of the things that I've discovered over the last couple of years is we actually have seahorses, not just here in the UK, all the way up to Scotland, but in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, quite cold waters. And a couple of years ago, there was a sighting over in Canada as well. So this animal that's supposedly very tropical, that lives on coral reefs, doesn't. It lives in a wide variety of stuff. So the surveys allows us to understand individual animals, their distribution, and what's actually going on in the wild.
To this day, he says, many people remain incredulous.
We get that reaction virtually every day, to be honest. I mean, you only have to look at our social media and people saying, I just didn't believe they existed. And what we did and the way we proved it was just showing them the photographs, showing them the video, getting out there, talking to people. And the reaction even now, people say, no, they just don't exist. They're a mythical creature. They've been Disney-fied, to be honest, because everybody thinks they're just a creature from Little Mermaid or Finding Nemo or something like that. But they're actually a true, amazing animal, from the tiniest ones to the biggest ones. So, yeah.
And some apparently remain doubters even as they plunge into the water alongside him.
We've had several volunteers that come out with us, and I just know from talking to them, they don't actually believe we'll ever find a seahorse. They just, you know, like I say, think they're mythical and all the rest of it. You very often hear people screaming underwater because they've seen a seahorse, shouting, it's a seahorse, it's a seahorse. You know, how they don't drown, I'll never know. But yeah, they get really excited. And it is an amazing thing to see because you're going through the seagrass or the different areas where the seahorses live and, you know, suddenly you see a shape and you think, how is it we never saw them before? They're so distinctly seahorse-shaped that you think, how did I miss that? How did I not see them? And they are perfectly camouflaged. They're fantastic.
As a lifelong diver who loves marine life, Neil's fascination includes much more than just seahorses. He's a huge fan of orcas too, and he'll never forget the moment he made eye contact with one while he was on an inflatable Zodiac boat in a Norwegian fjord above the Arctic Circle.
Suddenly, this female orca just literally came up beside us, and she had her head upright, and I was staring into this beautiful eye, this stunning animal, and that was one of those wow moments. It really made me think, wow, you know, what is going on in there? I mean, there's so much intelligence, so much emotion. That experience of looking into the eye of that female orca will stay with me forever.
When it comes to encounters with larger species, the magic for Neil can often be found precisely in that kind of eye contact. Like the time he was diving with a filmmaker off the coast of Sudan.
I ended up at 76 meters, so like 76 yards underwater, next to a hammerhead shark, a female hammerhead. And again, it's something about the eyes. I was swimming on level with her, looking into the eyes, and after about 5 minutes or so, she obviously got bored with me. She literally flicked her tail and was gone. Really deep down, I could never have followed her down. But I started to work my way back at the reef, and it was a calculated dive because we had lots of spare cylinders and regulators up the reef, so we could decompress, and I decompressed for the next couple of hours as I went up. But just looking at that beautiful animal swimming along, and then looking at the micro life on the reef, the tiny things that make up a reef, from the smallest little shrimps to the Christmas tree worms to the shoals of fish. I mean, nature is actually quite an amazing thing, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, we are very blessed to share our planet with such incredible creatures, but we've got to do something about it, otherwise we're going to lose them and lose them forever.
But Neil is decidedly not a pessimist.
I'm a true believer that we can do something about this now. We have the abilities and the skills and the knowledge to actually reverse that trend, but we've all got to work collectively to actually do it.
Storytelling, the kind of storytelling that helps people see the invisible seahorses that are hiding in plain sight, that's a huge part of Neil's vision. And it's not his vision alone, by the way. And he suggested that we reach out to one of his seahorse diving buddies, a guy out in California.
You need to talk to one of your fellow Americans called Roger Hansen. He's been building seahorse cities down in California, so he'd be a good one to talk to. One of the amazing things about the world I work in is you meet characters like Roger. Roger is pretty amazing. He tells the story in his own right and in his own way. People like Roger telling that story will get people involved in preserving our natural world. They will get so interested in it, they'll never want to lose it.
We followed up on Neil's endorsement of Roger Hansen, and Roger did not disappoint. Up next, we'll hear from Roger about how a kid raised in Iowa ended up building seahorse habitats in California. And along the way, we'll meet a courageous male seahorse named Kenny and a skittish but personable female named Daphne. I'm Eric Schultzke, and you're listening to Constant Wonder.
I want to shine a spotlight on another incredible show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called Top of Mind, and it resonates in a big way with those who want to engage with the important, tough issues facing our communities, but who are dismayed by polarizing and divisive approaches to these issues. Each week, Top of Mind tackles one tough topic. Award-winning host Julie Rose talks with guests about complex, challenging perspectives, and the Top of Mind experience doesn't aim at persuading you to change your mind. Instead, it opens a door for empathy and clarity in the interest of becoming better citizens and kinder neighbors. Listen to Top of Mind wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder.
Kenny was this giant orange seahorse. He was almost a foot long. And I had a yellow tent stake, plastic stake with a magic marker number on it. And it's funny, like if you had 50 sticks down there, they would have their favorite stick. So I would find like bed number 8. I knew that was Kenny's. And then I go, okay, he's on his favorite stick. That's about here. And then I would shine my light, and I would see this little orange tail wrapped around a stick, and I go, hi, Kenny.
Roger Hansen is a retired school teacher, a citizen scientist, a scuba diver, a scuba instructor, who frequents the waters of Kenny's former home off the coast of Long Beach, California. Roger discovered that seahorse colony in 2016. And as with the seahorses in England, these were not supposed to be there. They were 100 miles north of their presumed range limit. Roger studied and nurtured this tiny seahorse group for 6 years. And on one of Roger's frequent visits, he showed up just in time to save Kenny from an untimely demise.
I went down in October of 1 year, and there was a big two-spotted octopus over his favorite stick. Usually when anybody comes around him, they take off, boom, gone, and they squirt ink and swim backwards and away. This one would not let go. And I looked real carefully at the bottom of his stick, and I saw that orange tail. So I realized that a big two-spotted octopus was draped over Kenny.
Most scientists would probably have let nature take its course, but Roger was a friendly diver, not a detached scientist, and this wasn't just any orange male seahorse tail he was seeing under the octopus on the stick. This was Kenny.
One by one, I had to peel each leg off. It wouldn't leave until finally when I got where there was one leg left, the octopus took off. I respected the octopus because I studied them, but I moved as many as I could away from that area so that their hunting zone wouldn't be where my seahorses were. Kenny was fine, but I always thought maybe he needed therapy. Man, I would need to go to counseling if it happened to me.
Roger didn't view this hungry octopus as a villain. Everyone down there, he knew, was just trying to survive. And Roger had been observing and trying to help octopuses long before he stumbled on the seahorses.
Some octopuses are not very wise. Some will build their homes under rock, and some will build their home right in sand. They'll dig a hole, and then those fish will torture them for 150 days in a row. So all the predators, when that time comes, are lined up in a circle around there, just waiting to attack. During that time, they're heckled 24/7. So I would build a Fred Flintstone home over them. Two walls, a back, and a roof. And I left the front open in case they wanted to go eat, but then they didn't have to protect all areas around them. That's what I was doing when I found a seahorse swim by, was building octopus homes.
So what brought Roger to these murky waters off the coast of California to begin with? That story begins in Mexico, where a troubled young schoolteacher had gone to shake off his Midwestern winter blues and went scuba diving on a lark.
36 years ago, I went on a vacation to Cancun and tried a resort course just because I was curious. And I loved the ocean, and it was just entirely different than land where we always walk around on. It was a new environment. It was quiet, totally different structures, elk coral. There's some sharks down there. Fish I had never seen before, only saw them on television. It was a quiet world that I just absolutely loved. When I came back from my vacation, I immediately took scuba lessons because I wanted to be a part of the environment that I liked so much. I took every class I could get up to the point that I became a scuba instructor and taught others as well.
Raised in Iowa, he was teaching high school in Wisconsin. So much of his early diving practice after he got back from Cancun was in frozen lakes.
The water usually was about 35 degrees. The air, sometimes minus 4 degrees. So it was quite an experience. They called me the beluga whale in Wisconsin because I had a small head. I was a white, and I had kind of like a tummy, like a beluga. And I liked the cold. So on many of the dives, my legs were bare even. Now I move out on the coast of California, and I go diving out at the oil rigs where it's cold, and I'll be down there in shorts, without even a shirt, and everybody else is in a dry suit. But my body has adapted to this because I lived in the Midwest where you had winter all the time. I just got used to it. Including today, the air temperature was 54 when I went scuba diving, and I wore shorts and a t-shirt. I saw the ocean and I said, I got to move here. That was it. So I left my teaching job and packed up and moved to California, got another teaching job, and became a scuba instructor out here in California as well.
So Roger says he settled into his new home not far from the coast, and he started diving regularly in Alamitos Bay off Long Beach. This was water with extremely limited visibility, often about 5 inches, he says. And then for about 5 years, he kept his eye on a colony of two spotted octopuses.
When I was studying them one day, I saw a seahorse swim by. January 30th, 2016, I had discovered a rare colony of giant Pacific seahorses. They get to be a foot tall. So immediately I got an ABC and CBS and KTLA and CNN and the Weather Channel.
And that serendipitous find turned him into a minor celebrity. Now, it's worth noting here that Alamitos Bay is, in its current state, not very natural at all. It's a heavily altered environment. Landfills and dredging have changed it. And yet somehow the wildlife have kept a foothold there. And a key turning point in this story came soon after Roger found the colony, when he had to improvise an artificial habitat to protect them from some local teenage athletes.
180 high school boys came with their footballs to play tackle chest deep in the water. And the seahorses were pregnant. So I grabbed 50 sticks, about 4 feet tall, and 50 palm fronds like you would see in yards. And I went back and I went down 15 feet deep to the mud flat in the bay and built my own biome, which is like a ecosystem for the seahorses. I didn't see them for 3 days because all those boys scared them away. And when I went back, they were all hanging onto sticks on the bottom of the bay that I built. And because of that, and it took 3 years, but they started to recognize that I was a friend and not a foe, and that I wasn't just some crazy old guy.
Constructing new seahorse-friendly habitat became a kind of obsession for Roger. Basically, he was building additional habitat to supplement the original area where he had first made the discovery.
I first found them in eelgrass, which was about chest tall. But when winter comes, that eelgrass rolls down and dies, which I thought, oh no, they're going to leave. So I built more biomes. I named one Vegas, the other one the Bellagio, stuff like that. You have to imagine this. I hauled 1,000 of those sticks down on the bottom. It took a while, and stuck them in the mud flat with the idea that maybe I could get some more seahorses, come on over and hang on. And at one time I had 17 biomes down there so they could move around, and the sticks gave them a place to hang on to. That's an anchor point in seahorse talk. And the eelgrass gave them cover. And in that cover, you'll find Daphnia, or we call it zooplankton, microscopic stuff. That's their food source. They eat 3,000 a day. Science says they're voracious hunters. They just sit there and suck them in is what they do. So they had shelter and they had food, so they stayed. Once I got on television, I was taking so many pictures, I scared most all of them away until I realized that I wouldn't have any left. So I put my camera away. And for 5 months, I watched from a distance. And that's where I learned each one had a personality. I learned the personality. I gave everybody a name. But I learned to read their body language, and I built trust. And that took me quite a while. And then when I felt confident that I could move in closer, I did, and was very respectful. I had to change me, what really had to happen. It took about 3 years. And once I did that, then I was really accepted as a member of the herd, if you will, and permitted to come and go. I was a fish then.
The seahorses got used to him, but Roger was more than a fish, of course. At one point, he was also a seahorse matchmaker, and that is how Kenny, the orange male who survived that octopus assault, first got involved in the colony.
There was a boy seahorse, and I named him Toby. And all of a sudden, he ended up missing. I don't know why. And I had two girls. I had Daphne, and I had Bathsheba. And they went erratic. I could see their behavior was so different. I thought they were going to leave. They swam around. They were moving all over. They wouldn't sit still. And I go, oh, they're going to leave. Well, I had seen another seahorse 2 miles away up the coast. And I had put a yellow stake down there, and I kept an eye on him, and it was a boy, and I never saw him with a mate ever. He never was pregnant, and I never saw anything. So one day, I decided I'm going to go get Kenny, and I put him in a bucket with salt water, and I moved him down, and I took him down to bed number 8, where Bathsheba was, because she had lost her husband, and I let him go there. And the next day, their tails were wrapped. The next day.
Over the 6 years that Roger kept tabs on the colony, he got a sense for their routines. He observed that while the gents tended to stay home with their pregnant bellies, the ladies would come and go with the tide, intermittently checking back on the home front to see how things were going.
Girls like to have fun. They took off during the day. I think they're some very slow swimmers, seahorses. And I noticed that the girls would jump the tide. And when the tide went out in the middle of the bay, they would often go. And then they would come back later in the day when the tide rolled back in. But every day, they would go see baby daddy 2 or 3 times to make sure he was okay.
Now, with the females out with the tide, the males at home were often stuck with Roger, and they seemed to be puzzled as to what the human was up to. He spent a lot of time just sitting, staring at them.
The boy seahorses, of course, get big and fat, and they'll hang on to a stick, and they won't do anything. So I would lay down and watch them, imagine me in scuba gear 15 feet down and maybe 5 feet away. When they would get tired of me, it was really funny. Kenny was one of them, and Deep Blue was another, and Toby. When they got tired of me, they wouldn't leave. They would just slowly turn around and face the other direction on the stick. And so I would go on the other side, lay down 5 feet away and look at them kind of face to face. And when they got tired of me, they would just slowly rotate around and face the other way. And know what they were saying to me? They were saying, "We like you, Roger, but it's time for you to go."
How long would it take before they gave you the cold shoulder?
It would vary. It depend on if I was very calm and didn't move too much, maybe 8 minutes. Everyone was different, too, because they each have their personalities.
I think you can tell that Roger was very fond of all of his seahorses. And you would think that maybe he'd make a point of not playing favorites. But when the Seahorse Whisperer was pushed on that point, he did offer a name.
Yeah. My favorite was Bathsheba.
Tell me about her.
Yeah, she just would sit like on a perch and just watch you as you worked. You know, I guess if you have a person that's just amiable and kind and gets along with everybody, that would be her.
Now tell me about Daphne.
Daphne was a seahorse unlike any of the others. Anytime you looked at her in the eyes, she would swim away. No other seahorse ever did that. I followed her one day just to see where she would go. And unusual behavior. She swam up to where the sand and the water meet, right on that edge, turned on her side, and swam sideways to get away. Okay? Another day I followed her, she swam up and leapt up about 3 feet straight up onto the sand where she would have passed away if I had not got out and put her back in. I took 24,000 pictures, and the only pictures I really have of her, one good one, was that I took at 2 in the morning. Long Beach gave me a pass to dive all night long beyond curfew, so I could do that. I went down with a light, held it to my chest. I knew where she usually lived. I went there. I held it above her head, straight down, took one quick picture because I didn't want to hurt her eyes with the light, and left. That's my best picture. I have it mounted on a hat, stuff like that. The rest of them, all I have is her swimming away. That's it.
Did Daphne ever warm up to you?
Let me just say, the word tolerant was a better word. I did learn this. Every seahorse has its own personality. But she was the alpha and the omega. She stayed with me for 6 years. But to do that, I had to understand and respect her individuality. I was a school teacher for 38 years, and working with students, that's one of the skills you have to have. You have to understand everybody's different, and you got to roll with the punch, and some are going to have good days, and you got to keep your cool.
So you knew Daphne for 6 years. What's the lifespan of one of these creatures?
Science says 4 to 5 years. Daphne lived 6, which makes her story special. She was just really small when I first met her, maybe 2.5 or 3 inches, you know, in length. We don't talk about tall, but length in seahorse life. To up to where she was about 11 inches in length when I didn't see her. She was the last when that oil spill came.
Tonight, new details are emerging about what may have caused the biggest oil spill off the coast of Orange County in decades.
It came in the bay, and you could not see 2 inches. At that time, most everything that I had seen pretty much exited. I hope they made it out. Normally, when something like that happens, they head to the ocean to get away. So it was a 6-year period from about 2016 to 2022 where predominantly I saw them.
Roger says he's done calculations to project how many seahorses may actually have been in the bay when the oil spill hit.
A seahorse male will have 800 babies, of which 1 or 2 will make it. Based on those and the number of birthings I saw, there should have been at least 75 that made it.
He says the bay is 268 square acres, and that's an area of murky water far too large for one or even several divers to canvas thoroughly. But he thinks the seahorses are still out there.
Yes, they're still there, but to find them is really like a needle in a haystack. It's just difficult. So I still go. I still check all the areas, but finding them is another thing.
Roger says in addition to looking for seahorses, he's now back to studying and helping octopuses. But Roger credits diving and especially his seahorses with transforming his life. Before moving to California and becoming a dedicated diver, he admits freely that his life was in chaos.
I didn't recognize what was happening, but I was changing internally. I would say my life beforehand was filled with bad decisions. I'll take the blame for that. You know, I spent a couple days in jail one time. I was in the backseat of a squad car 18 times. I didn't do anything violent, but I am bipolar, which means I think really differently. And my behavior was where I had to go get checked out. That meant 9 times I had to go sit in a mental hospital for 2 or 3 days. And that is totally flipped. It is amazing. I don't have any issues. I've been with my current wife 24 years. I go to church. I go to Bible study. I'm calm. I'm relaxed. Everything changed. And I think what happened was that God came to me on the bottom of the sea because he knows that's the only place I would listen.
Roger's personal transformation is partly a result of the time he spends underwater. But he says that those 6 years with those little creatures was pivotal in changing his life. As he was learning about them, he was also learning from them.
They don't care about politics. They don't care about race. They're nice every single day. Why can't I be nice to people like they're nice to each other? And I suddenly realized that fish were teaching me how I should behave. And I guess what that really showed that there was a transition happening inside of me. I'm very thankful that happened, and I was very blessed that those little creatures were put in my life.
Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. Our guests today have been a couple of model citizen scientists whose passion became a hobby that led to some interesting scientific contributions. Neil Garrick Maidment is an accomplished diver and the founder of the Seahorse Trust in Great Britain. Roger Hansen is also an accomplished scuba diver and a dive instructor, and he is a retired high school teacher in California. Today's episode was produced by Mamie Teeples with sound design by James Call. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.
I'd like to take just a brief moment here to introduce you to another gem from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called In Good Faith. You can immerse yourself in a soul-nourishing experience of spiritual exploration. Stephen Cap Perry is the host, and he features people of diverse religions and spiritualities. He always interviews them with an aim to come upon a genuine understanding of the guest's relationship with the divine. Maybe you're wanting to strengthen your own relationship, or maybe you just feel a hunger for thoughtful conversation that touches on faith and belief. Whatever your need, it's truly rare these days in the media landscape to find conversations that unfailingly nourish and uplift your soul. In Good Faith does that every time, and you'll find it wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder.